Well, I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum. How are you, Martin?
Good, thank you, Michael. And it's always great to join the pod.
Well, there's so much going on, it's almost impossible to know where to start. The former Prime Minister of the UK, Liz Truss, is about to become the former Prime Minister. She fell on her sword. It seemed inevitable. We've got so many other things happening. I see the Iranians are sending personnel off to the Crimea to help the Russians fly the drones to attack Ukraine with. Great issues in Fremantle as to whether or not Woodside should be dropped by the Dockers as one of their fossil fuel sponsors. We've got industrial action in Western Australia over the nurses. Homelessness remains a huge issue. And to top it all off, Martin, do you see that the would-be world champion of chess, Neiman, is suing the current holder of the title because he got called a cheat? And somebody who's not going to take no for an answer are the Greens around Australia, particularly in the Commonwealth Parliament. So let's start with Liz Truss. What lessons are they going to be drawn by leaders around the world from her demise?
Look, I think it's fascinating. And I reckon there's a couple of points I'd make here. Firstly, I think that she's the fourth Prime Minister in Britain fallen on their sword in the aftermath of Brexit. Well, and that I don't think it's a complete coincidence. So Brexit was this really attractive idea to many voters, but it's actually been really unhelpful in terms of their own economy and in terms of trying to help them solve their problems. So that's probably a background and a shadow, but you can't always land on Brexit. There's something else going on there too, right? You've got a party membership that elects their party leader, and whether that party membership's views are aligned to the broader electorate is another thing entirely. So Truss was extremely attractive to Tory party members when she talked about, oh, look, two governments too big, cut taxes, everything will be all right, we'll have magic growth. And of course, we know that things are a lot more complicated than that. Something that appeals to a party member may not go that well. And some of the other contenders actually said this is really dangerous and won't work. But, you know, their voices got shouted down. And I think this has shown to be an absolute disaster. And, hopefully they've got to think about the way they redo things. But look, the Conservative Party in the UK is in an absolute mess and they've still got two more years to govern. You hope for the sake of Great Britain they can get their act together because it's not doing anything for the future direction of the country.
It wasn't so many years ago when the Labor Party in particular was changing its leaders that they also changed the rules for electing a leader and gave the members a greater say. Will this loss of Liz Truss, do you think, lead to a rethink of how the Australian rules for leadership selection work?
It's a potential issue. It's a potential issue because I would say none of our party memberships in Australia align directly with the broader electorate. And look, that's okay because you join a party because you have a particular passion for a certain ideology. That's normal. That's why you go into politics, I think, especially in Australia. But I think that when you're electing leaders, you've got to be cognizant of the broader issue and whether both themselves and the issues that they're pushing are going to fly. And I think it's probably just at this stage food for thought in terms of our own political parties here. The other thing to mention about the Conservative Party is it is heavily factionalised at the moment, and that's where Brexit didn't help because there are a number of people that are very aggressive about Brexit, not just making it happen, but happen in a certain way. They're used to getting their own ways in that way in that party, and that's probably hasn't helped. And if you think in New South Wales Liberal Party, they had a similar problem too with heavily factionalised party. They didn't even select candidates in key seats until the closing moments before the election, and that was an election they were calling themselves. So, whenever political, and all, a lot of political parties experience it, whenever they get too factionalised, it's a huge problem.
Martin, if the writing seemed to be on the wall in the last week or so for Liz Truss, it also seems to be on the wall for the Woodside Petroleum Company as a major sponsor of the Fremantle Dockers, we're seeing a lot of movement by individuals of sporting note. Pat Cummins, for example, the Australian cricket captain. We're seeing it in netball. People getting antsy about who sponsors are. And, of course, the Fossil Fuel Brigade, or the Anti-Fossil Fuel Brigade, would like to see Woodside cease as a major sponsor of the Dockers. In fact, an opinion piece has been published overnight on the Fremantle Shipping News by a contributor saying it's time for Woodside to go. What do you make of all of these movements? I mean, it's, people say politics shouldn't intrude into sport, but...
Well, it always has. You know, politics and sport have never been completely separate. And you're probably going back 30-odd years now when tobacco sponsorship was eliminated from sport, actually ended up being banned by the government from sport. So we haven't got to that stage yet at all. I think it's natural that sport, because sport's a reflection of broader society and the values of organisations need to be, I'm not that surprised to see this kind of move happening. And if you think about Fremantle, Fremantle's an area where considerations for the environment are probably more prominent and visible than most other parts of WA. So if you're the Fremantle Dockers, then it's something you're going to have to be mindful of. So it's not that big a surprise. I suspect what we'll see is a transition to other sponsorship. And I think there's probably an opportunity for Woodside to be thinking about what they're doing and how they're doing it. Clearly, in terms of that public image, there's more work to do.
It really is an interesting question, isn't it? And I must say, at a personal level, I can hardly believe that the AFL still seems to be making a lot of room for gambling. Presumably, that'll be the next target for campaigners.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. There's a lot of double and triple standards here. I think you can't watch a footy match without having gambling ads plastered left, right, and centre. They've got these small disclaimers at the end about problem gambling, but they're definitely pushing hard for a number of years now on, you know, you can't watch sport without gambling. It's part of the experience, they say. So I wouldn't be surprised if that becomes another issue and becomes a target. So it's in, you know, you talk to business, that ESG space around the social license is a huge area. And if businesses aren't on top of that, they're going to get caught out. And sport's one way of doing that.
Martin, a group no one's opposed to, that I've come across anyway, are nurses everywhere in the world. And anyone who's ever been hospitalised or had to spend professional time in the company of nurses is impressed by their dedication and their skill and their commitment to their community. They're not very happy at the moment, however, with the West Australian government. They'd like to get a bigger pay rise than what's on offer, and they'd like to see their terms and conditions of engagement changed. What are you making of what's happening? It sounds like the Minister and the Premier are taking an intransigent line.
Well, it's interesting. We had to chat about this last week, and I think we were predicting then it still had plenty of water to go under that bridge, and so it's turned out. They are very much in their entrenched positions. And the thing about nurses are people really value their contribution. So they've got, you know, we talked about social license. I think a group of nurses have a pretty good social license in that respect in terms of their role in the community. So I think that that's something the government's really going to have to get on top of. I suspect there will be more negotiation and compromise here. And we saw that in a brief way around a brief statement about nurses to clients, patients, nurses to patients, staff ratios was put on the table. I think we might see more of that. And the other thing that will be up for discussion is double shifts and, you know, how often they occur, et cetera. So it's not just about wages. They're often the simple part, but it's also about the conditions as well. So watch for more in that space. I think it'll be really interesting.
Martin, lest we forget, there's still a war going on in the Ukraine, primarily in the Ukraine. The Russians, as we know, started off with a special military operation, trying to send a message it'd be over in a few days, and many of us thought it probably would be, but it's not turned out that way. Ukraine are fighting hard. They're well-provisioned, increasingly well-provisioned by the West. But now we see Iran having made some political choices, and somebody else's enemy is suddenly your friend. And They're providing drones to Russia, the Iranians, and they're sending personnel, I'm informed, off to the Crimea to help better target them in Russian hands. And every war seems to produce, every major sort of skirmish seems to produce a sort of a testing of new products in warfare. So I think we see drones are going to be quite effective, not just for spying in your neighbour's backyard, but for dropping bombs in them. What do you make of this development, with Iran's intentions and involvement, and B, what does this say about the state of the war and where it might be headed?
First, on the drones part, I'm quite concerned about drones in warfare. They make me uncomfortable because one of the reasons deterrence for going to war is the cost that you incur. And not that we want anyone to lose lives, because that's awful, but the loss of life is part of a cost that might deter someone from wreaking havoc and destruction on someone else. When you have drones, you have more risk-free warfare in a kind of way for the people that are using it. But of course, that's not risk-free warfare for the targets and the people caught up in the targets. So it doesn't matter whether it's Iran and Ukraine or whether it's the US in northeastern Pakistan, which they've used drones quite a lot. They're troubling developments because I think then you see war as something happening at arm's length, and when it has a really awful, visible impact on the day-to-day lives of that entire country and people. So that's my broad rant, if you like, on drones. Generally, drones in warfare make me uncomfortable. But I'm not that surprised to see Iran dipping in and helping out, because both Iran and Russia are kind of pariahs in the West, and your enemy's enemy is your friend. So I think that they see a lot of value at the moment in sticking together. And Iran has their own difficulties, and I know there's probably a lot of Western sympathy for some of the protests by women, particularly young women in Iran at the moment. So there's a lot of synergy between Iran and Russia, who've always got along. But to balance this out a lot, just consider that there's an enormous amount of help that Western allies are giving Ukraine. So it's not all happening on one side. We've sent Bushmaster vehicles to Ukraine, and most of the air defences that the Ukraine have are supplied by the US, as well as a ton of other technology. So this has become a proxy war between Russia and the West, and it is a disturbing thing because there's always this constant risk of escalation, which should worry us all.
It is interesting about the drones. When you were making that point, they're not entirely indiscriminate, but in many ways they are, and remind me of the awful evil of the landmine on the ground. These things are up in the air. Talk about things being sort of on the ground and up in the air. Can we talk about the Greens? They seem to be going through a tumultuous time. Adam Bandt, according to some people, threw his chief of staff under the bus because he only found out latterly that Senator Thorpe had been in a certain type of relationship. Her future in the Greens seems to be up in the air, and perhaps they're fighting their way out of it by saying that the Greens aren't going to support anything that isn't green enough when it comes to resource development. They don't like what's happening up in the Northern Territory. They don't like what's happening on the Northwest Shelf. Are the Greens in a bit of a sticky spot at the moment, Martin?
They are. They are in a tricky spot. So let's talk about Lydia Thorpe, then I'll talk about where the Greens might sit more broadly. So the problem with Lydia Thorpe, I think, was it was a conflict. It was probably on top of a range of other challenges that faced Adam Bandt and his relationship with Lydia Thorpe, who was more outspoken on a range of issues than he was. And so that creates tension. So there's a backdrop of already tension there. And then you have this conflict of interest. No one really cares who your personal relationships are until they impact on your job. And you can't be on a law reform committee which accesses a whole range of sensitive classified information if you're in a relationship with a very prominent bikie.
Or even just a good friend of.
Yeah, I think the sensible thing is to leave the committee. And then you can pursue other relationships like that if that's your choice. That's a fairly straightforward issue, but it plays into a broader problem around division within the Greens. And any political party, you know, as soon as you get division, it makes life extremely challenging. Where the Greens sit more broadly is that they were, I think it's easier for them if there's really obvious points of difference between them and Labor. And if you have a Labor government that's travelling reasonably well and pursuing some of the things that Greens MPs and members are keen on, then where do the Greens sit in all of that? You know, where's that point of difference somewhat? And you've got a Labor government that's pursuing the Voice, which I think is very popular, particularly amongst Greens members. You've got Labor government that's put in more robust targets than we saw previously around carbon emission, not as robust as the Greens would like, but made some progress on that. You've got a Labor government that's moving on an integrity commission, which again has been a longstanding policy of the Greens. So unless the Greens can stake out their own turf again and say, we stand for something profoundly different from Labor, then they're in a bit of strife. Because, you know, we've got a Victorian election coming up where a lot of inner city seats are up for grabs, et cetera. So there's, you know, that competition within the left is actually quite an interesting one to watch. So where will the Greens go? I think that point of difference will be around those fossil fuel projects and particularly gas and other things like that. Energy will be the key area because Labor is not going to go as far as the Greens in that policy area. That's my assessment. I think that we'll see the Greens trying to stake out their turf a bit more clearly and differentiate themselves from Labor.
Martin, to finish off our discussions today, a topic that rarely goes away from public policy or community life is the question of poverty. Quite broadly, it always seems to be with us as the Jesus Christ character in Jesus Christ Superstar said to one of his disciples when asked what he was going to do about poverty. An obvious manifestation of poverty is homelessness. Fremantle Shipping News have been trying to cover this topic recently and on Wednesday night hosted with St. Pat's Community Support Service in Fremantle a forum on homelessness in Frio. It was a wonderful night. More than 60 people attended. There's a story up on the Shipping News about it. And many local people were anxious to do something, to find out how to do it. There was a statistic that something like 800 people on any night in Western Australia are having to sleep rough, as we say, and about half of them get turned away because they can't be accommodated. And when I say accommodated, I mean it. Don't have anywhere to sleep that we would consider to be a home or an apartment or even a proper shelter. The big question is, will governments, federal, state, and to the extent that they can, local, engage in this process more actively? There's obviously some move on the social housing front, but what's your take on government response to homelessness?
Well, I think it's a really persistent and ongoing issue that governments generally have not been that successful in addressing. They really struggled with it. I think in the cold hard reality, governments of all persuasions, including the current government, have not been able to get enough social housing out on the market. That's not the right word, but available for people who lack housing. So that's part of the challenge. And there's been, a range of other logistical things that they will say fed into that, you know, the availability of the right tradespeople and all those people in the process and the skills shortages that we have and all of those things. But this is not just a recent issue. It's actually been with us for a long time. So there's that piece around the provision of housing. There's also the provision of the right services in the right place that wrap around good housing that are part of the solution here. And I think more broadly, all of us have got to think about whether we're prepared to accept this because that's happening in the midst of us. You know, we have a fantastic, amazing community in Fremantle for those of us that reside or work here, but it is, you know, a harsh reality that this is part of our community too. And so how can we all work towards that solution? So government's part of the problem, but can businesses, have they got any role? in helping provide a solution. A lot of innovative solutions in the past in other countries have involved partnerships with businesses where people provide lower cost housing, and in return, the government guarantees leases and offers to help with maintenance and all of those issues that come with in the social housing space. So in effect, private companies who build houses more effectively and quickly than governments ever can get involved in the solution. So I'm not saying that's a panacea, but we just need to think about every single possible idea and put it on the table.
Oh, Martin, that's a very thoughtful and excellent summary, which will help a lot of people to appreciate just what is at stake here. Shipping News will be sponsoring more forums on this topic because there's a demand from the community to do so. I think we're going to have to leave the politics of chess for another day, but it's probably better fodder for the next chess movie out of Hollywood, I suspect.
That saga, if ever sort of a movie plot's got suited to that, it's got to be that chess saga. Yeah, upstart, young, brilliant guy, takes the chess world by storm, cloud over his head. Is it true? Is it not true? Is the establishment closing ranks on him because he's a threat, or is he just part of this dodgy online brigade that's undermining the game? I think it's fantastic intrigue. Yeah.
All right, we'll have to, by the sound of it, devote an entire view from the roundhouse to the topic. Thanks for joining me today, and let's hope the politicians will have another lovely, eventful week and keep providing lots of fodder for us to talk about.
They will. Thanks, Michael.